3. Arkady ordered a couple of cappuccinos in the coffee shop. We took them to a table by the window, and he began to talk. I was dazzled by the speed of his mind, although at times I felt he sounded like a man on a public platform, and that much of what he said had been said before. The Aboriginals had an earthbound philosophy. The earth gave life to a man, gave him his food, language, and intelligence, and the earth took him back when he died. A man's own country, even an empty stretch of spinifex, was itself a sacred icon that must remain unscarred. Unscarred, you mean, by roads or mines or railways? To wound the earth, he answered earnestly, is to wound yourself, and if others wound the earth, they are wounding you. The land should be left untouched, as it was in the dream time when the ancestors sang the world into existence. Rilke, I said, had a similar intuition. He also said song was existence. I know, said Arkady, resting his chin on his hands. Third sonnet to Orpheus. The Aboriginals, he went on, were a people who trod lightly over the earth, and the less they took from the earth, the less they had to give in return. They had never understood why the missionaries forbade their innocent sacrifices. They slaughtered no victims, animal or human. Instead, when they wished to thank the earth for its gifts, they would simply slit a vein in their forearms and let their own blood spatter the ground. Not a heavy price to pay, he said. The wars of the 20th century are the price for having taken too much. I see, I nodded doubtfully. But could we get back to the song lines? We could. My reason for coming to Australia was to try to learn, for myself, and not from other men's books, what a songline was and how it worked. Obviously, I was not going to get to the heart of the matter, nor would I want to. I had asked a friend in Adelaide if she knew of an expert. She gave me Arkady's phone number. Do you mind if I use my notebook? I asked. Go ahead. I pulled from my pocket a black, oilcloth-covered notebook, its pages held in place with an elastic band. Nice notebook, he said. I used to get them in Paris, I said, but now they don't make them anymore. Paris? He repeated, raising an eyebrow, as if he'd never heard anything so pretentious. Then he winked and went on talking. To get to grips with the concept of the dream time, he said, you had to understand it as an Aboriginal equivalent of the first two chapters of Genesis, with one significant difference. In Genesis, God first created the living things and then fashioned Father Adam from clay. Here in Australia, the ancestors created themselves from clay, hundreds and thousands of them, one for each totemic species. So when an Aboriginal tells you, I have a wallaby dreaming, he means my totem is wallaby. I am a member of the wallaby clan. So a dreaming is a clan emblem, a badge to distinguish us from them, our country from their country. Much more than that, he said. Every wallaby man believed he was descended from a universal wallaby father, who was the ancestor of all other wallaby men and of all living wallabies. Wallabies, therefore, were his brothers. To kill one for food was both fratricide and cannibalism. Yet, I persisted, the man was no more wallaby than the British are lions, the Russians bears, or the Americans bald eagles. Any species, he said, can be a dreaming. A virus can be a dreaming. You can have a chicken pox dreaming, a rain dreaming, a desert orange dreaming, a lice dreaming. In the Kimberleys, they've now got a money dreaming. And the Welsh have leeks, the Scots thistles, and Daphne was changed into a laurel. Same old story, he said. He went on to explain how each totemic ancestor, while travelling through the country, was thought to have scattered a trail of words and musical notes along the line of his footprints, and how these dreaming tracks lay over the land as ways of communication between the most far-flung tribes. A song, he said, was both map and direction finder. Providing you knew the song, you could always find your way across country. And would a man on walkabout always be travelling down one of the song lines? In the old days, yes, he agreed. Nowadays, they go by train or car. Suppose the man strayed from his song line. He was trespassing. He might get speared for it. But as long as he stuck to the track, He'd always find people who shared his dreaming, who were, in fact, his brothers.
Yes.
From whom he could expect hospitality, and vice versa. So Song is a kind of passport and meal ticket.
Again, it's more complicated.
In theory, at least, the whole of Australia could be read as a musical score. There was hardly a rock or creek in the country that could not or had not been sung. One should perhaps visualize the songlines as a spaghetti of Iliads and Odysseys, writhing this way and that, in which every episode was readable in terms of geology. By episode, I asked, you mean sacred site?
I do.
The kind of site you're surveying for the railway?
Put it this way, he said. Anywhere in the bush you can point to some feature of the landscape and ask the Aboriginal with you, what's the story there, or who's that? The chances are he'll answer, kangaroo or budgerigar or dew lizard, depending on which ancestor walked that way.
And the distance between two such sites can be measured as a stretch of song.
That, said Arcady, is the cause of all my troubles with the railway people.
It was one thing to persuade a surveyor that a heap of boulders were the eggs of the rainbow snake, or a lump of reddish sandstone was the liver of a speared kangaroo. It was something else to convince him that a featureless stretch of gravel was the musical equivalent of Beethoven's Opus 111. By singing the world into existence, he said, the ancestors had been poets, in the original sense of poesis, meaning creation. No Aboriginal could conceive that the created world was in any way imperfect. His religious life had a single aim, to keep the land the way it was and should be. The man who went walkabout was making a ritual journey. He trod in the footprints of his ancestor. He sang the ancestor's stanzas without changing a word or note, and so recreated the creation.
Sometimes, said Arcady, I'll be driving my old men through the desert, and we'll come to a ridge of sandhills, and suddenly they'll all start singing. What are you mobs singing? I'll ask, and they'll say, singing up the country, boss, makes the country come up quicker.
Aboriginals could not believe the country existed until they could see and sing it, just as in the dream time the country had not existed until the ancestors sang it. So the land, I said, must first exist as a concept in the mind, then it must be sung. Only then it can be said to exist.
True.
In other words, to exist is to be perceived.
Yes.
Sounds suspiciously like Bishop Berkeley's refutation of matter.
Or pure mind Buddhism, said Arcady, which also sees the world as an illusion.
Then I suppose these 300 miles of steel slicing through innumerable songs are bound to upset your old men's mental balance.
Yes and no, he said. They're very tough, emotionally, and very pragmatic. Besides, they've seen far worse than a railway.
Aboriginals believed that all the living things had been made in secret, beneath the earth's crust, as well as all the white man's gear, his aeroplanes, his guns, his Toyota Land Cruisers, and every invention that will ever be invented, slumbering below the surface, waiting their turn to be called. Perhaps, I suggested, they could sing the railway back into the created world of God.
You bet, said Arcady.